One of the more durable developments in child abuse treatment and prevention in the last few decades has been the birth and growth of children's advocacy centers, CACs. Both Jackson and Josephine County have them. Take a more child-centered approach to investigating child abuse, a gentler obtaining of evidence and statements from kids. Children's advocacy centers are accredited by the National Children's Alliance. NCA's boss plans to be in Medford for a child abuse symposium next week. Teresa Wiesar is the executive director and our guest on The Exchange right now. Thank you for joining us, Teresa.
Thanks for having me.
For the people who may not know, can you give us a description of how children's advocacy centers work?
Sure. When children who are alleging being sexually abused come forward and tell their story to a trained forensic interviewer within a children's advocacy center, that statement is digitally recorded so that it can be used in court or in other ways. Most importantly, they're questioned in a way that's neutral and non-leading and legally sound, and by someone who's really trained to do that in a way that's non-traumatizing for them. More importantly, in follow-up to that forensic interview, they get assistance that they need to heal. So they're going to get a complete medical evaluation, and they're also going to need get whatever mental health care that they need, evidence-based treatment that ensures that they heal from that abuse. So that combination of care is so critically important to making sure that these children go on to thrive.
Well, the key would certainly seem to be the interviewer and the skills that that person is provided with. Does it tend to be a therapist? Does it tend to be a police officer with specialized training? Can it be any of the above, really?
Well, it really could be any of the above as long as they have specialized training. Whether you're a police officer or a therapist or anything else, you don't come trained to talk in a developmentally appropriate and non-leading way to especially very young children. And so that specialized training really has to happen to any professional who would have that role. And, you know, there's been a lot of research over the last couple of decades about the way in which kids need to be asked these questions. And so we know a lot about both how to conduct that kind of training and how to monitor it to make sure that the interviewers are following the right question protocol in these kinds of cases.
I know the Southern Oregon Children's Advocacy Center's got some training and launch information from the one in Huntsville, Alabama, which oddly enough is another place I used to work. Was that the first, or how far back do CACs go?
That's right. CACs have been around for about 35 years, and the first one started in Huntsville, Alabama, by a local prosecutor who had had a case in which the child asked, you know, out of the mouth of babes, I suppose, you know, why can't you people ever talk to each other, after she had been interviewed over and over and over again inappropriately by police, teachers, and other professionals. And so, you know, he had the brilliant thought of, why don't we bring all of these people together, let's talk to kids one time, and let's make sure that they get the treatment that they need to heal. And this is now developed in 800 communities around the country.
Well, with roughly 800 of them now, first of all, have they generally met the expectations set out for them?
Well, more than 600 of them are accredited with us, meaning that they meet certain very specific performance standards. And I think that, you know, that growth and development has been wonderful in terms of quality of care for kids and the satisfaction of their parents and caregivers with the care that they have received. But there are these others around the country that are in very early stages of development. And our hope is that as they develop, they will also develop in a way to meet these performance standards.
With fewer than 1,000, are there still many areas of the country that don't have access to children's advocacy centers?
Unfortunately so. Despite that rapid growth across the country, there are still 40% of counties in the U.S. where children do not have access to the help and hope within a children's advocacy center. And we work hard every day to see new ones develop because we think it's so critically important that this response is available to all the kids who need it.
Did the National Children's Alliance form specifically to give accreditation to children's advocacy centers?
Well, not only to give accreditation, although that's a really critically important role, but also other types of technical assistance and training. Overall, making sure that children's advocacy centers have the support they need to do their job well is fundamentally what we're about. In addition, we're a grant-making organization to children's advocacy centers. The Victims of Child Abuse Act funds startup funding for children's advocacy centers and also some implementation funds to improve their services. That federal funding flows through MTA to local children's advocacy centers.
NCA is the National Children's Alliance, which Teresa Wiesar is the executive director of. She's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. This is a discussion you're welcome to join, like any and all here on the program. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So interesting. So how long has NCA been around to help funnel the money to the local CACs?
We first received Victims of Child Abuse Act monies in 1990, although we were formed a couple of years earlier than that. So, you know, we have a long history of knowing what works in the development of children's advocacy centers and also knowing where there are room for improvement and where we want to continue to build good practice. And I'll say that, you know, Oregon has really been on the forefront within their children's advocacy centers in terms of a medical response to these cases, ensuring that the children receive high-quality medical evaluations, but there are other parts of the country where medical examinations are not available as broadly, and we're working very hard to make sure that's the case.
So in looking at what CACs do well, need to improve on, what are some of the basic criteria that they have to meet to get accreditation from NCA?
Well, there are several things. For one, they have to be a child-friendly setting to begin with. They really are oriented from top to bottom around what's best for children. Secondly, of course, there are training standards and ongoing peer review requirements for forensic interviewers to make sure that their skills are at the highest level. In addition, there are standards, and they have to have services in place to have a robust medical response for these kids, not just in terms of the collection of evidence for cases, but making sure that they're overall healthy. And then they have to be able to provide evidence-based mental health treatment, because no matter what happens in the legal aspects of a case, we want to make sure that kids get better, that instead of developing PTSD or other trauma symptoms, that in fact they're able to go on with their lives, to cope in school, and to be okay at home. And the only way that really happens is to ensure that they have that mental health care that they need. So, you know, that's not all of our standards, but that's certainly the core set of them. Another piece, though, that I would just mention that's important is around victim advocacy. We know that many of the things that families struggle with in these cases involve not only the ongoing court case, but even basic things like making sure that they have transportation to appointments that they need, making sure that someone is advocating for them on an ongoing basis and getting them information about their case. So that's another critical component that CACs provide.
When you say evidence-based mental health treatment, what form does that usually take?
Sure. I'm glad you asked. Now there are more than 40 evidence-based mental health treatments, meaning that there's research that supports their effectiveness in reducing trauma symptoms. There are lots of mental health treatments and interventions that are available in the community, but not all of them are specifically tailored to reduce trauma symptoms. So things like trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, child and family traumatic stress intervention, and others are specifically tailored to reduce those trauma symptoms so that kids can sleep better at night, they can pay attention at school, and they can get on with their lives. And so we want to make sure that children really do have that treatment that is tailored very specifically to the trauma symptoms that they have.
Even without children's advocacy centers, does the kind of follow-up care that children need exist in many communities? Or there are some places that are just essentially deserts where kids are going to be interviewed under fluorescent lights in a cold room by a police officer and on down the line?
Well, while I would say improvements have been made overall, and I think there is a general understanding among law enforcement that there's a need to question children in a more developmentally appropriate way, that doesn't necessarily translate into child-friendly settings or translate into having appropriately trained individuals in those places without a children's advocacy center. So in too many places around the country, really, if there's no children's advocacy center, the response is much like it would have been 30 years ago across the country, meaning children are going to be interviewed at schools, at a police station, maybe even at their home with the offender sitting in the next room. And that's just completely inappropriate. And we want to make sure that that's not what's happening, and that in those communities where that's still going on, that even before there's a children's advocacy center, we can at least extend some training resources so that those multidisciplinary teams can form and can improve their practices as they work together towards getting a children's advocacy center.
So, for example, is there a generally accepted book, Teresa, on how to interview a child? I mean, the setting for it, the kinds of questions to ask, that sort of thing. Is that pretty much universal even without CACs?
No, I wish I could say it was. There certainly are books that outline forensic interviewing principles, and you know, folks can avail themselves of the many research articles on that. But I think the issue is also that an individual not only needs to be trained, but they need to have an aptitude for talking to young children. I mean, you and I both know that the fact that someone is trained on a certain series of questions to ask doesn't necessarily mean they really like or enjoy engaging young children. And so I think that there's a component of this that, yes, is about training, but it's also about ensuring that these are folks who want to do that role with young children. The other thing that I would say is many people have a lot of reticence around issues of sexual abuse. And so, again, you can have someone who likes young children and likes talking to them about all kinds of other things, but would feel very uncomfortable questioning them around issues of child sexual abuse. So you sort of have to have this combination of things. And there's still many places across the country, especially in rural and underserved and geographically isolated places, where that's just not the case.
We're talking to Teresa Wiesar, who's the executive director of the National Children's Alliance, which provides support and channels funding and provides accreditation to children's advocacy centers across the country, including the two in Southern Oregon in Jackson and Josephine counties. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. That's our phone number. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Teresa, I understand one of your duties while in Medford for a child abuse symposium next week is to present an award.
Well, I hear that, that I will be presenting an award, and I'm, you know, excited to have the opportunity to do that. And I really appreciate overall Medford, you know, inviting me to come out and talk about innovative programming and CACs, and also to recognize good work in the local community. I think that, you know, to whatever extent that I can highlight the, you know, outstanding work of local multidisciplinary teams and the great work that they're doing every day to help heal kids, you know, that's one of the most rewarding parts of my job.
I notice you didn't say who's getting the award. Is it still a secret?
Well, I don't know for sure whether or not they've been notified or whether they would like me to make that public. So, you know, I don't mean to be coy about it. But since I haven't been given that active release, I just don't feel like I can do that on air right at this moment.
Fair enough. I noticed that one of the sessions at the Child Abuse and Neglect Symposium you'll be attending is social media, which certainly begs the question, is the tracking and prevention of child abuse always something of a moving target with new complications all the time?
It absolutely is. And one of the things that has been, you know, the more dark side of social media and the internet in general is the way that that has been used to perpetrate crimes against children. Whether that's been in terms of the posting of photos or videos of their abuse, whether that's been through bullying, whether that's been through the bullying of victims, even when people come out and disclose, you would wish people would be supportive. That's not always the case. Whether that's been, you know, in terms of trying to educate young people about the dangers of sexting, I mean, there are just so many ways that this continues to evolve, and we want to ensure that local communities are aware of what's going on nationally, and also that they have the ability to respond, and also that cutting-edge information is really brought forward, and I think there's been some very good practices around this, both investigatively and also in terms of response to victims. I think one of the things that we have to really give thought to is when somebody is victimized and any part of that has an online component, that really exists forever. It's forever in the public domain. And so victims wind up being re-traumatized over and over and over again because they always worry that someone's going to know about their victimization because what's been posted online about that. So, you know, I think that we have to be a good support to folks, and it's important for your listeners to know that one of the ways they can support victims is, you know, when they see these kinds of things posted as a part of social media, to really reach out with, you know, care and kindness as a way of subverting the kinds of negative messages others may be receiving.
Which begs another question about how can people be aware but not, you know, wary to the point of hair trigger reaction to things that might be odd enough to warrant reporting or asking somebody to report?
Sure. Thanks for asking that question, because I do think that every single, you know, person has a role to play in the prevention of child abuse. And if folks want more information about recognizing signs of abuse, they can go to onewithcourage.org to learn more specifically about those signs. But I think the important thing is, you know, for any adult, if you get that kind of uh-oh feeling about what you're observing, whether that's something that you know, appears to be physically abusive, or it just doesn't seem right in the way that an adult seems overly interested in a child in terms of grooming behavior, you know, always wanting to be with children in a way that seems appropriate. They don't seem to be really spending a lot of time around other adults. Or if a child says, you know, I don't want to spend time or go over to so-and-so's house, that should be taken seriously. And it's enough to make a report. It's important to know that when you make a report of child abuse, you're not declaring that abuse has happened. You're telling a professional who is trained to screen that and evaluate whether it's something that warrants further investigation. So I think sometimes the general public, you know, they don't really understand what happens when they report, and they may be worried that, you know, they have to absolutely know for certain. Not at all. The reason that you make a report is because you're reporting a concern, and just like if you were reporting a suspicious person in the neighborhood or a suspicious happening at a house next door, it's the same kind of thing. You're reporting the suspicion, and you're letting the professionals investigate that.
That website you mentioned is One With Courage, onewithcourage.org. We'll link to that from our website as well. In the minute or so we have left, do you have any idea of numbers in child sexual abuse? I mean, as people learn more about it, they seem to report it more, which makes it seem like the incidence is on the rise. Do you have any kind of handle on the incidence?
Well, we do know that at a minimum, that 1 in 10 individuals, boys and girls, are sexually abused by the age of 18. And certainly girls are much more likely to be sexually abused than boys. But the thing to know is that those statistics are based on those that report. And we know that many, many more people do not ever report or may only tell people about it in adulthood because they're afraid. And so we would just ask for more folks to come forward as they become aware of these concerning situations.
Teresa Wiesar is the executive director of the National Children's Alliance, which provides support for children's advocacy centers like the one in Medford. She'll be in town next week as the CAC of Jackson County presents a child abuse and neglect symposium. I want to thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
All right, take care.